you know, some people whose ideas are not so bright might need a little enlightening, and that's a part of what we're here about. Is this on enough? How many think it's enough? How many think it's too much? Okay, all right. So, let's go to Matthew 5, verse 19. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Now, we may be so familiar with these analogies that we think that the meanings are obvious. But as Matthew writes, it can help us to remember that he writes from the perspective of what Jewish people in Jesus' day needed to hear and understand about him and his teachings. And that meant that he referred directly to the Old Testament teachings and prophecies a lot. And Matthew records those, refers to those more than the other gospel writers, because he seems to be especially interested in the fulfillment of, of prophecy, so that the Israelites will know that Jesus is the Son of God. But there are also some things that Jesus' listeners probably picked up on that were indirect reminders, that, Matthew here doesn't refer to the Old Testament directly. But there are these indirect reminders of the history of the Jewish people and their relationship with God and the promises of God. So if we can go a little deeper, we might get a little more of the flavor, no pun intended, of Jesus' teachings. So the questions we should ask are not just what salt and light mean to us, but what those elements meant to them and other people of their time, for that matter. We know that salt was used for flavoring, as it is for us, but it was also used for its preservative characteristics. And it's still used for that more than we might realize. Think of bacon and ham and pickles. Wouldn't be much without salt. But which aspects of the use of salt were most important to Jesus' listeners? Well, probably it was those preservative qualities. They didn't have refrigeration, and so preserving food even beyond one meal could be difficult. And so that's where salt often came in. But for the Jews, there was an additional meaning that was drawn from the preservative quality of salt, and it was used by God himself in an additional way. So let's go to Leviticus chapter 2 and read this. Season all your grain offerings with salt. Do not leave the salt of the covenant of your God out of your grain offerings. And salt, add salt to all your offerings. Now those were grain offerings, not meat. So it wasn't to preserve the grain, but it was representative of this covenant of salt. And then look at, Numbers 18. Whatever is set aside from the holy offerings the Israels present to the Lord, I give to you and your sons and daughters as your perpetual share. It is an everlasting covenant of salt before the Lord for both you and your offspring. The Lord said to Aaron, you will have no inheritance in their land, nor will you have any share among them. I am your share and your inheritance among the Israelites. Now that was said to Aaron. And remember last week we learned that both Jochebed, Moses and Aaron and Miriam's mother, and Amram, their father, were from the tribe of Levi. And God chose that tribe to be the ones who were priests and who served in the temple in other ways, even if they weren't priests. They were actually the closest thing to government employees as they had. They didn't get land. They didn't get an inheritance of land like all the other tribes did. So they didn't have their own flocks and crops, at least not on land that they owned. They got only 10 cities. So they were the city folks. And they got portions of the tithes and sacrificial offerings. That was how they lived. God said, I am your inheritance. And so that was an everlasting covenant of salt. And then finally, let's look at 2 Chronicles 13. and this is a story. Abijah stood on Mount Zemaraim in the hill country of Ephraim and said, Jeroboam and all Israel, listen to me. Don't you know that the Lord, the God of Israel, has given the kingship of Israel to David and his descendants forever by a covenant of salt? Now, what was going on there was there were, at that time, two competing kingdoms made up of Jews. Abijah had 400,000 men from the southern kingdom, which was called Judah, and they were going to go to war with Jeroboam, who had 800,000 men, twice as many. They represented the northern kingdom that was called Israel. But because Jeroboam had introduced worship of golden calves, and because of the covenant of salt with David, Abijah's army, Abijah was a descendant of David, was used to kill 500,000 of the 800,000 men of Israel. These were Jews. 500,000. Now, let's fast forward back to Jesus' day. The Jews of Jesus' day were trying to avoid some of the grave mistakes of their ancestors. But they don't really get the main point of many of God's laws and prophecies. But one thing they were counting on was the permanence of the covenant. And salt represented that permanence. So when they heard Jesus talk about salt, they thought of this salt of the covenant, or covenant of salt. The main thing they missed was the nature of the kingdom that was promised to David and his descendants. That's where the title of the series of the lessons from Matthew comes from, the upside down kingdom. They were hoping for and expecting a kingdom based on the typical ways of most governments. Typical governments exert force over those below each layer of society and suppression if anyone resists. So those at the bottom are the least honored and the most oppressed. The Jews were being severely oppressed by the Romans at this time. They did want to turn that upside down so that they would be, though, the oppressors who could force everyone to obey them. So they wanted the kingdom to be turned upside down, but not in the way of Jesus' upside down kingdom. Jesus' upside down kingdom is more completely upside down. It doesn't rely on force at all. It relies on all of the qualities of followers of Jesus that are seen in the blessings or beatitudes that we work through. So let's read those together once again. Blessed, everybody. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So those characteristics and qualities are nothing like the characteristics and qualities of Roman governors and tax collectors and soldiers. None of what they hated about the Roman government is seen in those blessings at all. The Romans were anything but poor in spirit, or mournful over their sins, or meek, or hungry for righteousness, or merciful, or pure in heart, or peacemakers, or willing to suffer persecution for righteousness. But the Jews of Jesus' day actually thought that happiness would be found by becoming like the Romans and oppressing them and the rest of the non-Jewish world. That's what they were hoping for. So, as they listened to Jesus, if they had not just heard Jesus telling them about these blessings and these characteristics, the statement, "You are the salt of the earth," would have led them to think of the permanence of God's covenant represented by covenants of salt, but they would expect something more like the slaughter of 500,000 of Jeroboam's soldiers. Maybe the slaughter of 500,000 Romans. So think about this. For those who are really listening with ears to hear, as Jesus will later say, they are being reminded of prophecies like Isaiah 42:6, where the lasting covenant of salt and the metaphor of light are introduced. So look at these words spoken through Isaiah the prophet. I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness. I will take hold of your hand. I will keep you and will make you to be a covenant for the people and a light for the Gentiles, to open the eyes that are blind, to free captives from prison, and to release from the dungeon those who sit in darkness. So these themes are repeated and expanded through many chapters of Isaiah, but especially look at Isaiah 49, beginning in verse 5, the last part of verse 5. My God has been my strength. He says, it is too small a thing for you to be my servant to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I have kept. That's not enough. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. So if you want to do some advanced homework, read all of Isaiah 40 through 55, all of those chapters, and look for language about light and covenant and release from the captivity. More than 20% of the references to light in the Old Testament are in Isaiah. So Jesus was fulfilling this covenant and these prophecies in unexpected ways. And just as we don't get everything the first time we hear it or read it, I'd say that most of Jesus' listeners did not get the full impact of what he was saying, but they did begin to notice that he sounded very different from their religious and political leaders. They said as he spoke, that he spoke as one with authority in contrast to their religious leaders. In other words, they could tell that he knew what he was talking about. He wasn't just repeating thoughts and arguments of other rabbis like they did. That was their typical way of communicating and, you know, in their educational circles. But what they were saying is, we have this permanent covenant, these everlasting promises from God. These are ours. Well, Jesus says, you are the covenant. You are the covenant of salt and a light for the Gentiles. You are the promise. And this is a huge difference. When Mindy was a toddler, we had a record that had a song, You Are the Promise, with a capital P. And, you know, it was a really cute song. But do non-Jewish followers of Jesus fulfill these same roles? Or were Jesus' words just for that audience at that time? I mean, were only Jews actually the promise, the covenant, or are we the promise too? Well, let's take a look at what Paul says about the makeup of Israel. Who is a part of the true Israel? I do not want you to be ignorant of this mystery, brothers and sisters, so that you may not be conceited. He's talking to the Gentiles. So that you Gentiles may not be conceited. Israel has experienced a hardening in part until the full number of Gentiles has come in. Into what? Into Israel. And in this way, all Israel will be saved. So we're all Israelites. Israel, along with all of God's promises, his covenant of salt, consists of all of those who live by faith, like Abraham and Moses. And in Paul's ministry at that time, more Gentiles were following Jesus than Jews. But he tells the Gentiles not to be conceited, because the door is open for the Jews to come back in and enjoy full participation in the fulfillment of God's covenant. And that's still open today. So, yes, we are a promise. So here's the question, though. How do believers save or preserve those who are not believers? How does that work? What's the mechanism? Well, one parable of Jesus later on in Matthew 13 helps to explain that. Jesus told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. When the wheat sprouted and formed heads, then the weeds also appeared. The owner's servants came to him and said, "Sir, didn't you sow good seed in your field? Where then did the weeds come from?" "An enemy did this," he replied. The servants asked him, "Do you want us to go and pull them up?" "Let both grow together until the harvest. At that time, I will tell the harvesters, first collect the weeds and tie them in bundles to be burned. Then gather the wheat and bring it into my barn. Well, the disciples don't understand this, much less probably any of the other listeners. So they asked for an explanation. So then he left the crowd and went into the house. His disciples came to him and said, "Explain to us the parable of the weeds in the field." He answered, "The one who sowed the good seed is the Son of Man." That's himself. "The field is the world, and the good seed stands for the people of the kingdom. The weeds are the people of the evil one, and the enemy who sows them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the harvesters are angels. As the weeds are pulled up and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will weed out of his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. They will throw them into the blazing furnace, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Whoever has ears, let him hear." Now, it's true that we're not always so good. But here's the point. If it were not for the existence of the good people in the world, really the people of faith, all of the people in the world would be destroyed immediately. But the truth is not only that God doesn't want to hurt the good people, he also wants to give those who are still living as instruments of the enemy to have a chance to be humbled and hear and obey. So he doesn't destroy all of us immediately, even though we're not always so good. But God sees us, the children of faith, as his children because of our faith in Jesus. So we have been given the role of preserving, saving the world from complete corruption. We are the covenant of salt. When Brenda started college a couple of years before me, she started going on mission trips to Germany, and we went on some after we were engaged and married. And then, you know, we went to Germany for a time. But she just started going on these summer campaigns where they would go to the small churches in Germany. Most of them were no bigger than us. But when they went there, they would stay with the little churches, would host the kids who were on the campaigns. And Brenda and Luana, her friends, stayed with a family, the Knoblos, in Augsburg, where Gisela was a member of the church in Augsburg. But Herr Knoblo was not. But he really did enjoy having the girls. So Gisela would always volunteer to keep a couple of girls. Well, the church there hosted those groups every year for many years. And I don't know exactly how it came about, but I have to believe that Gisela acted as a covenant of salt through the faithfulness of being patient with her husband through many years until finally Herr Knoblo became a follower of Jesus too. Now, one aspect of being the salt of the world is that we never give up on people, just as God never gives up on us. The other aspect of being of the salt of the earth is that we sort of flavor it. Well, how do we do that? Well, we make it more palatable, less bland, less boring, more meaningful. And that was kind of what the girls did, I think. But we can give people hope when they see the fruit of the Spirit in our attitudes and actions as we live our lives. It doesn't have to be anything dramatic. We had a friend named Tori in Montana who had very little money. She cleaned houses to supplement the family's income. But Tori was always going to garage sales or finding things in thrift stores that people might enjoy or just be amused by. And Tori would, you know, buy those things and give them to them. And Tori brought a lot of flavor into people's lives just by doing little things. Everyone in that church would have agreed that she was kind of the light of the church in a way. The church was a better place. The world was a better place because of just little things. Well, one of the most tragic trends in America today is the number of teens and young people who don't see life as good. And so we can encourage them and people of all ages by living with joy and hope through all of our circumstances and encouraging them in their lives and all of their circumstances. And that kind of brings us to that light metaphor. I once thought that I had an original thought. After hearing that darkness is actually not a thing, that darkness is only the absence of light, I thought maybe evil is not a thing, only the absence of good. Well, it turned out that it was not an original thought after all. Albert Einstein said it this way. He wasn't a Christian, but he was a believer in God. He said, God did not create evil. Just as darkness is the absence of light, evil is the absence of God. Thomas Aquinas said, good can exist without evil, whereas evil cannot exist without good. And so, no, I don't believe I belong in the category with Einstein or Thomas Aquinas. You know, as they say, even a stop clock is right twice a day, so I'm just a stopped clock. But the truth is, no matter how brilliant or dense we may be compared to others in our world, we bring enlightenment to the world, not through our brilliant thoughts or even through achievements. We light our world with love through without limitations based on merit. Didn't put those quotes up. So remember what Paul said in Romans 5, God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So again, we light our world with love without limitations. Love without limitations based on merit. In other words, we don't only love those people who deserve to be loved. We did not come to be loved by God because we deserved it. And so we bring the brightest light into our world when we love others who might not deserve it. And this light pierces the darkness in our world. And others who witness that kind of love are changed by it. Have you ever been on a tour in a cave when at some point they turned out all the lights? And they did that when we were deep in Carlsbad Caverns. And you could almost feel the darkness. Well, because darkness is not a real thing, you can light a match and light just a birthday candle. And the darkness can't hide that candle. It may not enlighten, you know, it may not brighten the whole cave, but it's not going to darken the light because darkness is not a real thing. Christy McClellan, the teacher whose lessons the women's Bible study group is currently enjoying, she tells about five grandmothers who were in one of her Holy Land travel groups. And they were telling her about how they began their study and prayer group in Nashville, which is sometimes called the buckle of the Bible Belt. But after they had enjoyed just studying and praying together for a good while, they decided, you know, we should find some action that we could take to apply what we believe in. So they came up with a crazy idea. They decided to make some blessing bags, and I don't know what they put in them, maybe just homemade bread or cookies. It wasn't for homeless people. They started taking them to the exotic dancers at clubs in Nashville and just loving on those girls and on the bouncers, you know, just loving on them. Now Christy didn't give any dramatic details of results. We always think that we got to see results to know whether something has done anything. But I have to believe that some of them saw the light of Jesus' love in one of the darkest corners of Nashville, spiritually speaking. You know, there's just five grandmas. So we may not have opportunities to do something quite to that degree of contrast to the darkness in our world, but think of all the tragedies and the hateful behavior and the life obstacles that our friends and neighbors suffer. You know, some of them are suffering because of their own choices. Others are victims of others' choices. But all of those are weeds that are planted by the enemy. And some of those weeds are people. Some of them are circumstances. But they're all weeds that God allows to grow in and around our lives until. So we don't understand that. We don't like that. We shouldn't like it. But in the end, many of those people will be separated out and thrown into the fire. But until then, we have opportunities to help the victims of the enemy's mischief to see light and eat from the good fruit that we not only have as gifts from God, but also to experience unexpected and sometimes unexplainable love from us. And this happens because we don't just see the light. We don't just have the light. We are the light. So now we're going to enjoy a song. We won't be able to sing along with it so well. It's not the type of song that we normally use that we can easily sing along with, but it's from a group called Sanctuary at Lipscomb University in Nashville, Tennessee, that is directed by our friend Randy Gill. But the song just fits this so well. So let's stand together and sing as well as you can and think about what this means in our lives.